Well, hello to all our faithful listeners at Radio Solar System. Once again, we have a planetary science news item in the early part of our course. And this is a little bit longer than some of the ones we normally do, but most of it consists of images, so bear with us on that. We're going to give you some information about one of the most interesting projects that's going on at the moment, and that's the James Webb Space Telescope, which truly is a marvel of engineering and is potentially one of the most informative things that is going on in terms of understanding things about the early history of the universe and also understanding things about exoplanets. So it fits very well with some of the material we talk about in Module 3. It illustrates some concepts in solar system arrangements, if you like, and the nature of the solar system, and also allows us to introduce a couple of bits of information about exoplanets, which are one of the things that we're interested in this course. So let's just move along, and we'll give you a quick overview of what we're going to talk about, and then we'll dive right into it. So the next slide just gives you some information here. This is an orbital telescope, one of a number of orbital telescopes that now are up there. The earliest one, of course, was the Hubble telescope. But this is the most powerful space telescope that's ever been put out there, away from the Earth. And it's gone a long way from the Earth for specific reasons, to avoid interference from natural radiation and also the radiation that we create. And it really is an amazing feat of engineering. It's intended to do a number of different things. Understanding the solar system is just one of them, but it really has a primary objective that's much wider: cosmology, the idea of the early history of the universe and how we might get information about it. But another important part of it is part of what's called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI, because the JWST will also give us a way to get much better information about exoplanets, in other words, planets that orbit other star systems. So, first question you might have in your mind is, well, what is cosmology? And that's not a particularly easy question to answer. Moving along to slide 3, I hope you'll forgive the picture, but when I read stuff in cosmology, I immediately think of Alice in Wonderland, because it seems like such a fanciful world. We're talking about things that we really can't get our heads around very much. I mean, how did the universe begin and why does it exist? And is the universe truly four-dimensional or does it have many different dimensions? These are the sorts of questions that cosmologists address. And sometimes it seems like they're talking an entirely different language that belongs in the pages of a fantasy novel. But we won't get into too much detail about this. We'll give you enough of a taste of it to make you think about it, but perhaps not get too much of a headache. But the important thing here, from the perspective of the space telescope, is that it's going to look in two directions. It's going to look outward in physical space for billions of light years, but it's also going to look backwards in time as well. And that's the important thing about looking at the far reaches of the universe. Next slide. So here you are, here's a sort of fanciful picture of the universe, and at the bottom scale you see the time since the Big Bang, which happened about 13.8 billion years ago, we believe. Okay, and in the bottom right-hand corner of this image you can kind of see what we think of as the visible universe. Okay, so we can see with regular light out to a certain point in the universe. However, we can actually see beyond that using other types of electromagnetic radiation. And when we do this, when we look to the outer reaches of the universe or to other galaxies, really what we're doing is looking back in time. We're looking through a time machine. And the other thing to remember is that, as you will discover later on when we talk about it, the radiation that comes from distant objects is not the same as the radiation that was initially generated at their source. It's changed by the motion of those sources. Those distant galaxies and things that we see in the outer universe are moving extremely fast, and that affects the radiation that comes from them. So we don't see them in a visible sense. There's a limit in the universe that we can't see beyond with our eyes, but we can see it in terms of other electromagnetic radiation. And the furthest thing we can find is what's called the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is kind of like microwave level, so it's like the stuff that does your cooking, but nowhere near as strong. And it's kind of coming from the outer reaches of the universe, very, very faintly. And I like to think of it as being a bit like the hangover from the Big Bang explosion 13.8 million years ago. It's no longer visible light. It was originally a very violent explosion, including lots of very short wavelength, high-frequency radiation, gamma rays and X-rays and things like that. But now we see it as microwaves. And we'll talk about how this happens later on in Module 5. But basically, to look back to the early ages of the universe, we have to look a very long distance, a very long way back in time, and we have to look in a different part of the electromagnetic spectrum than we normally look at with telescopes. Next slide. So here's a picture of the James Webb Space Telescope. Now, it's a reflecting telescope. We'll talk a little bit later on about the types of telescopes, not in any great detail. But it's also an infrared telescope. It's primarily focused on the infrared region of the electromagnetic spectrum. Here you see the primary mirror that's made of these beryllium panels that have a hexagonal shape. This thing actually had to fold out of the spacecraft when it was on its way from the Earth. And it's the largest mirror that's ever been placed in space. So that means that immediately this thing has higher resolution than anything else we've had before. Here you see some other parts of it. You see the secondary mirror, which sends the light back into the aperture, which then goes to the spectrometers and the other instruments. And all this stuff is hidden behind the sun shield. The sun shield is this purple thing here. It's a special device that's intended to keep it free of interference from electromagnetic radiation and temperature changes and anything that's not related to the distant sources. Because if we didn't do this, it would be very hard to pick up the very, very faint radiation that comes from the far reaches of the universe. Next slide. So, back on Christmas Day 2021, the telescope was launched, okay, and it travelled out to a location that we call L2. Now, L2 is one of a number of places of gravitational stability in the Sun-Earth-Moon system. So it's a place where the telescope can hang out and not be too much affected by the gravity influences from other bodies in the solar system or effects from the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, for example. It's also distant from terrestrial sources of radiation, and it's also on the other side of the Earth. So it's on the other side of the Earth from the Sun. So that means that the Earth is blocking out quite a lot of the radiation that comes from the Sun. So operating in the infrared region of the spectrum needs to exclude all other possible sources of infrared radiation in order to find the patterns that it's looking for. And it actually has to orbit a little bit around the L2 point. Okay? It can't stay there without using some energy to stay in orbit. Next slide, please. So it doesn't need a lot of fuel to do that, but it has to keep moving, not because of gravitational instabilities, but also because it wants to stay outside of the Earth's shadow and the Moon's shadow. It needs to have sunlight to drive its instruments, it needs power, but it also needs to maintain thermal stability so that the environment of the telescope is basically not altering in terms of its thermal characteristics over time. So that shows where it is. So think of the Earth as orbiting the Sun, and the James Webb Telescope is orbiting the Sun as well, and it's staying in the same position relative to the Earth. So it's always behind the Earth, but every so often, of course, the Moon is passing through there. So it has to maintain this through an orbiting process, and that means that it has a limited lifespan. It'll be up there for about 10 to 15 years, and then it's going to run out of fuel to keep that orbit in place. Now, it can image half of the sky at any one time, okay? But over a year, it can image the entire celestial sky, because, of course, it will orbit the Sun, and it will be pointing in different directions at different times, okay? It's always beyond the Earth and always beyond the Moon. So that's why it's out there, and it's the first telescope to be placed in such a location. Next slide. This is slide 8. It just shows the electromagnetic spectrum again. Why look at things in the infrared? Well, reason one is because the radiation from distant parts of the universe has been altered by the motion of those objects, which means that stuff that would have been visible is now down in the infrared. So if we want to see it, we want to image it, we have to look in that region of the spectrum. The second reason is that infrared radiation is not affected as much by dispersion and absorption by dust and gas that's out there in our galaxy or in other galaxies for that matter. So that means that we can avoid some of this interference, but some regions of the infrared are very, very good for seeing dust and gas clouds as well, because they radiate in that region of the spectrum. So that means that it's able to image both dust and gas and things like that, but also image stars and also image distant galaxies. including those that are some of the first that ever formed in the universe after the Big Bang. Okay, so that's the basic premise behind doing this and why it's an infrared instrument. But we can take infrared results and then shift them into visible colors and brightnesses in order to visualize those things. Next slide. And as I mentioned before, one of the functions of this telescope is to look at exoplanets, and particularly at exoplanet atmospheres too. Now, just imagine that we're looking at a distant star and an exoplanet orbiting that star passes between us and that star. That means that the radiation from that star has to pass through the atmosphere of the exoplanet, if indeed it has one. And that will give us information about its atmosphere, because the atmospheres of planets selectively absorb infrared radiation based upon gas molecules that occur in them. So JWST, soon after it was deployed, found carbon dioxide in exoplanet atmospheres, but that's not a surprise. We'd think we'd expect to find that anyway. It's quite common throughout the universe. But we want to find other things in the atmospheres of planets that might betray the presence of life. So that's a very important function of this project as well. Next slide. So this is just a simple slide from NASA's information. It just summarizes the mission's objectives. Note that NASA's not the only organization that's involved in this project. European and Canadian space agencies also have important roles, and one of the spectrometers on the JWST is actually designed and built in Canada as well. So that's a snapshot of what it's all about, and we'll spend the rest of this news item just looking at some of the images that have been obtained in about a year, a little more than a year, since the first images came from James Webb. But first of all, just a quick illustration of what the universe might look like if we could make a map of it. Well, in fact, there is a map of the universe. A map of the universe has been under construction for a number of decades now. Now, it's not a map on paper that you can roll out on a desk. It's all in a computer, and it's in three dimensions. But as I said before, it's really in four dimensions too, because the distant regions of the universe, of course, are not as we see them. They are what we see is what was there billions of years ago. A couple of things that are interesting about the universe is that it has this uneven distribution of matter, and these green things here are maps of galaxies in parts of the universe, in slices of a region of the universe, and you can see that it's not evenly distributed. Okay, we mentioned before about dark matter, which occurs in the center of many galaxies too. We don't know what this is, we can't see it, but that's perhaps one of the things that's responsible for clustering matter in the universe. Other questions are things like, when did the first galaxies and stars form, and what did they look like? So the JWST really has a lot of capacity to look at these things and actually give us first-hand information rather than speculation. Next slide. And it's also an order of magnitude in terms of technology difference from its predecessors. So here you see the difference between a Hubble Space Telescope image and the visible spectrum that shows one bright star there and a whole lot of distant stuff. This is like taking a grain of dust and holding it at arm's length and looking at it through your telescope. Okay, so this is a very small part of the sky. And there's the JWST image of the same area. And you can see how much brighter it is. You can see how much more things you can see in it. And you can see the variation of things in there. So that's an infrared image that's been translated to the visible spectrum to recreate what that would look like. Okay. So let's have a look now at some of the things that James Webb has seen in about a year of operation. Start out here, slide 13. Well, you know what this is? This is Jupiter. Okay. Again, it's a processed infrared image. Jupiter emits infrared radiation because it emits energy of its own, as well as reflected energy from the sun. Here you can see some minor moons. You can also see the rings of Jupiter. Well, maybe you can't see them. Can you find out where they are there? Well, my clue is that they're close to the moons. Okay. Now, this is not the primary objective of the Space Telescope program, but there's no doubt that looking at things within the solar system will give us a whole lot of new information. Okay. It gives us the ability to see planets in their entirety at once. Next slide. So why don't we go to Saturn? Here's another image of Saturn. This is from June of this year. Okay. Now, once again, here, it's a bit different than we'd see with a visual telescope. It's an infrared image, and Saturn absorbs a lot of infrared because it's got methane in its atmosphere. Okay? But the rings of Saturn are made of icy bits and pieces, and they reflect almost all the radiation, including infrared. So it allows us to see the structure of the rings in exquisite detail there. You can see what's called the Cassini gap, which is a gap in the structure of the rings, and we'll talk later on about how this formed. And on the left, you can see some of the small moons of Saturn, including Enceladus, which is one of great interest to planetary scientists. Next slide. Let's go a little further out in the solar system. Here's an image from James Webb of Uranus and some of its moons. Now, you could say that this image makes it look as if we're looking down on the rings of Uranus. Now, that's a rather dubious statement to make, and you're probably still laughing out there, but that's what it looks like, okay? But why is this? How is it that we actually take a picture like this? How is it that we seem to be looking down on the planet and its ring system here? Well, the answer is because the rings of Uranus are oriented at right angles to its plane of rotation around the Sun. That's one of the strangest things about the outer solar system and one of the things that we still have some trouble explaining. Next slide. Let's move a little further away now. Let's look at some distant galaxies. So this is an image of a faraway galaxy. It's a billion light years away. LIDA 2046649 in the constellation Hercules. Look at this exquisite image that shows its spiral arms and its bright core with thousands or millions of stars in it. Okay? It's very much like our own galaxy would appear in structure if we were to look at it from a distance as well too. But when the light left this galaxy, there were only single-celled organisms on our planet. And all the other things in that picture, pretty much all the other things, are other more distant galaxies that we would not even be able to see with visible light. You can see one or two stars that come from our own galaxy. They have this characteristic six-pointed diffraction pattern on them that I think is an artifact of the hexagonal mirror panels on the telescope. You can see one in center left there. But pretty much everything else on that represents material that's well outside our galaxy. Next slide. Now, this is a rather peculiar image here. This is very, very distant too. And this shows an effect called gravitational lensing. You can see these bright bands that you see in this picture, these orangey red bands. Now, what these are images of extremely distant galaxies that have been amplified and magnified because the light that comes from, or the radiation that comes from, has been bent by passing across a past massive clusters of galaxies. There's a cluster of galaxies here, and it's creating what's called a gravitational lens, because gravitational fields can also affect radiation and its path through space. And that gives us images of extremely distant galaxies that are magnified to the point where we can actually see things like individual stars within them, which normally would not be possible. Okay, so we will talk a little bit about gravitational lensing later on. It's a rather complex business, but it's very, very important because this galaxy cluster that's causing this effect is 6.3 billion light years from the Earth. So if you know, as you know now, that the Earth and the solar system are 4.5 billion years old, our solar system did not even exist at the time this radiation commenced its journey to us. And the stuff that's been magnified by the gravitational lens is coming from places that are twice as old as our own solar system, at least the very edges of the universe. Next slide, please. Another wonderful image, part of what's been called now the cosmic cliffs, part of the Carina Nebula. So we're in our own galaxy now, only 7,600 light years from the Earth. So really just recent history. Okay, and one of the key things about JWST is that it's able to look at radiation from different regions of the spectrum at exactly the same time. So that means that it can actually use frequencies and wavelengths that image dust and gas clouds very well as those that allow us to pick out stars and other things or particular types of stars. So this is an image that's produced by that kind of technique. So it shows you the dust clouds, which would normally obscure the clouds, but it also shows you the stars that are within them because it could pick them up. Okay, and in this, you can see that there's a clear region above where a lot of gas and dust has been cleared away by hot young stars that you see in this image. Next slide. And this is another one. This is the Tarantula Nebula, as it's called, a bit further away, 161,000 light years away from us. This was one of the early images from James Webb last year. And once again, this is a region of stellar formation, a region where stars and planets are forming. And you can see all the blue-white stars in this area that will be very short-lived. They will eventually explode in large nova or supernova explosions, and they will seed this region with heavy elements that can then contribute to planetary systems. And in this image, you can see dull red and orange stars quite a bit too, quite small ones. And they are actually infant stars. They're actually newly formed stars that are beginning to develop within this region. Next slide, almost there. This is slide 20. And what on earth is this? Well, this is a crazy pattern. It's called the Tree Rings of Space. This is a binary star system. It's about 5,000 light years from the Earth, where two stars are orbiting one another and coming close together about once every 8 years. When they do that, they create a gravitational influence that seems to disturb cosmic dust that's in a shell around them and gives these characteristic ring-like patterns, which then move outward and slowly disperse. So the James Webb Space Telescope will have the opportunity to watch this process more or less in real time as it takes images over its lifespan to see how this is happening. So the stuff that's coming out from this project is really quite amazing. It's going to change our view of many things and hopefully will lead us to finding Earth-like exoplanets in the future as well. Next slide. Slide 21 in our news item. Well, this is what happens when galaxies collide. But if we're going to be technically correct about this, these galaxies have already collided because they were colliding about 500 million years ago. Because this is a long way from the Earth. Galaxies were colliding and merging in this photograph to give us this distinctive shape. We can also see some nearby stars from our own galaxy here, shown by the diffraction spikes on them, and also lots and lots of distant galaxies as well. Okay, so there seems to be no end to the stuff that we can find. But last but not least, let's just have a look at some very recent news releases. This one comes from Monday, September the 11th. The James W. Space Telescope finds methane and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of a planet that's about 120 light years away from Earth, orbiting a small red star. This is a planet of a kind that's now considered to be extremely common within the universe. We're finding a lot of them. They're about 10 times more massive than the Earth, about the size of Neptune or a bit smaller, and they've been called mini-Neptunes or sub-Neptunes. They're also being called Hyacian planets quite a bit because they're considered to possibly be covered in vast water oceans and have hydrogen and ammonia-rich atmospheres. And there's nothing like these planets in our own solar system. We don't have a Hyacian planet. And there's a lot of speculation that they could be sites for life to exist, but that's certainly controversial, and if it does exist, it's certainly not going to be as we know it. There's no doubt about that. This is a very different kind of environment. Methane and carbon dioxide are not big surprises in exoplanet atmospheres. They're in the atmospheres of planets in our own solar system, as we know. Okay, but there are other things that we would much rather find in these atmospheres if we can. Next slide. This just illustrates how the atmosphere of an exoplanet is analyzed and understood. Again, it passes between us and its parent star. We happen to all be in the same plane on regular intervals, and that means that the light from the star goes through the atmosphere, and carbon dioxide and methane are very effective greenhouse gases. They absorb infrared radiation at specific wavelengths and heat up that atmosphere. We know this from the Earth, for example. So we see that pattern. We see that pattern of absorption at different wavelengths that tells us that carbon dioxide and methane are there. What we really want to see in the spectrum of an exoplanet atmosphere, of course, is oxygen and water, H2O, dihydrogen oxide. And we haven't yet seen this. However, a recent study also released on September 11th did an assessment of what would happen if another star system within the same kind of range had an instrument that was equivalent to the James Webb Space Telescope. And what would they see if they were looking at the Earth? Would they be able to detect what we call biosignals in Earth's atmosphere? By biosignals, I mean things that relate to the presence of life, oxygen being the primary one among them. The answer to this study was that yes, the James Webb Space Telescope, or an equivalent technological instrument in some other part of the galaxy, could indeed recognize the biosignals that come from Earth's atmosphere. So that brings us to the end of this rather long news item. This is the best known starship in human culture, the USS Enterprise. Supposedly, the Enterprise can take shortcuts through hyperspace, through different dimensions in the universe to get from star system to star system. Well, it's a plot device, and interstellar travel itself, in real terms, has some really fundamental problems that we will talk about. So the chances that we can ever go and visit another star system or another star are probably not that high, even if the university has some degree of curvature to it, the universe, I mean, not the university. If the universe is curved, perhaps it's possible to take a shortcut, but how short would that shortcut be? For the moment, anyway, the best thing we have is something like the James Webb Telescope, which is bringing us ever closer to these places. So, would you like more information about the James Webb Telescope? It's pretty interesting stuff. If you have an interest, you can find some here. There's a nice article in The Atlantic. You can get it online. If you only go in there once, you're allowed to look at it twice, I think, which has many of the photographs that I've used here. But also you can go to the NASA website, which is there all the time, and look at the James Webb homepage, which all has all sorts of stuff about the James Webb Telescope. And there's another interesting one on Live Science, which just came out this week, that has this information about the study ascertaining if a James Webb Telescope-like instrument could detect life on Earth from somewhere else in the galaxy. So there's three places you can have a look. I have one more slide. Now, typically after we think about things related to cosmology, we tend to have a bit of a headache because the distances are just so immense and the concepts are just so hard to grab onto. And back a long, long time ago, back in the 1980s, Monty Python's Flying Circus released what was called the Galaxy Song in one of their movies. Now, I don't think Monty Python have stood the test of time very well at all. I don't find them funny anymore. I used to. But the music and lyrics of this particular one have definitely stood the test of time. And it gives us an opportunity for a little musical break between this and the rest of the stuff in Module 3. So there are quite a different number of different versions on the internet of this. I've picked one that has a sort of educational emphasis, which you can get at this address if you'd like to watch that before you go to Module 3 and find out more about some of this stuff. So thank you very much. Sorry it was a little bit long this time, but there's a lot of stuff out there according to James Webb. Thanks a lot.